was time to go. At the house, Glory, still glowing from the day, announced they would stay up late. They sat on the steps of the deck, counting stars and swaying like a bunch of drunken sailors. Callie asked them to sing the sea shanty song so she could dance again, but none of them knew the words, so they made up nonsense words instead. Ginger wished there was a way to make time slow down. Glory stood up and beckoned her. They both stepped out onto the dark of the lawn.
"There's going to be a bonfire at the beach tomorrow night. Adults only. How would you feel about babysitting for a few hours? For Thomas, too? I'll pay you, of course. You don't mind, do you?"
The phone rang before Ginger could respond. Glory ran in the house to answer it. Back on the deck, Ginger could hear through the open window the sharp edge of her mother's question.
"Tomorrow? As in tomorrow, tomorrow? What time? You'll practically have to get up in the middle of the night to make that ferry." "No, I'm just saying. Why rush like it's an emergency?"
Her voice went steely.
"Of course I'm happy you're coming. Swear to God I am being strangled by worry warts."
There was silence, and then the flick, 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 flick of the porch light switching on and off, a signal that Glory wanted them inside. In the living room, they stood and watched her empty a puzzle box onto the table. She looked up.
"What am I, a TV program? Are you waiting for the commercial to come on?"
"Can we go back out?" Mimi asked. "To look for shooting stars?" Glory shook her head and started turning puzzle pieces right side up.
"Stargazing is over. Your father's on his way."
Chapter 14. The melted tea kettle seemed like an indisputable sign that Glory's brain was melting too. It was time for triage. The talk Ginger intended to have with Julia about her nose ring, the closed bedroom door, and Nick's lengthening visits was tabled. Now it was all about Glory. It took a single overnight at the Popkins for Mimi to offer to fund a full-time companion so Glory could age in place at home. Ginger, tasked with hiring someone, found the perfect candidate, a woman recently retired after 25 years as a kindergarten classroom aide. The staying-home part agreed with Glory, but the companion part did not. Her critical thinking might be flickering in and out like a bad cable connection, but her critical talking showed no sign of decline. She fired the former kindergarten aide the second day. Whether the next three companions were fired or quit was impossible to puzzle out. And really, it didn't matter. The fact was, they were gone. It was Richard who lobbied for Glory to move in with them. That she was difficult was beside the point. For Richard, having a parent, even a difficult one, live long enough to get old was a lucky break. Ginger agreed to a test run. After aide number 5 was hired part-time for when Ginger was at work, Glory moved into their home. On her first night there, Glory went to bed at 9, woke 2 hours later, confused, wandered into the bathroom half-dressed, and came upon Nick on the toilet. Both of them screamed and ended up at the foot of Ginger's bed, along with Julia, though by then all of them were laughing. Richard laughed too, but Ginger did not join in the merriment. The next morning, Ginger woke up with a rash that spread through the day from neck to trunk and down her arms. Hives was the diagnosis.
"Stress at home?"
the doctor asked as he handed Ginger a prescription. In an effort to keep the new part-time companion from getting fired, Ginger introduced Laureen to Glory as their housekeeper.
"Please try not to bother her while she's cleaning."
"Since when have I ever bothered anyone?"
At the end of her first day, Laureen gave her report.
"Your mother kept telling me to take a break from my smudgery. Also, she said I should get a hobby like puzzles."
Ginger explained about the family word mangling.
that by smudgery her mother probably meant drudgery, and that no matter what she said or meant, it was best to just smile and agree. Ginger thought Loreen was working out fine until the end of the first week, when Julia told her otherwise.
Grandma Glory refuses to eat anything the lady gives her for lunch, and after lunch, Grandma sits on one side of the couch doing nothing, and the lady sits on the other side of the couch and sleeps. Why do we even need her?
This was disappointing to hear.
We need her because Grandma can't be home alone while I'm at work. I'll just have to find someone else.
That's when it occurred to her.
How do you know what's going on at lunch? Are you cutting school?
God, we come home for lunch. I'm allowed to leave school for lunch.
We come home?
Ginger's rash spread to her back. The doctor called in an order for a stronger cream. Later, when Ginger struggled to apply the new ointment on the hard-to-reach spot between her shoulder blades, she realized that as recently as a week ago, she would have asked Richard to do it for her. The next morning, before the alarm clock went off, they heard Glory in the hallway.
Bathroom? No closet. Where's the bathroom? Hello? Anybody here? Is there a bathroom in this hotel?
Ginger turned to Richard.
This is not working. She's disoriented. I'm covered in a rash. Look.
She lifted up her palms to show him the most recent territory to become covered by bumps.
I don't think I can take it if she stays.
The doctor called in an order for cortisone pills, and Ginger made another try at convincing Mimi to take Glory in. Mimi had the ideal setup, a carriage house at the back of her yard, which could easily be repurposed as an apartment. Mimi was adamant. The answer was still no. Neil was convinced letting Glory move in would open the door for all future Popkins who were in between jobs, or had changing marital status, or just wanted to be closer to the fun.
Up to me. I'd do it in a minute, but Neil says no. Final answer.
Popkins to the rescue once again. Only one option was left. With Glory parked in the temporary care of a Popkin cousin for the afternoon, Ginger and Mimi shopped for a facility. They settled on the Meadows, a half-hour drive away. The final obstacle was selling Glory on the idea, but the intake nurse advised them on the best strategy. They were to tell Glory she was just coming for a visit. And so it was that when they pulled into the entrance of the Meadows, a diminished Glory with a bright red muffler wrapped around her neck, her belongings crammed into a single large Samsonite suitcase as white as her hair, Ginger pointed at the sign to her left which said, Rehabilitation, and Mimi swiveled her mother away from the sign to her right, which foretold her future, and long-term care.
You mean like a vacation?
Glory asked as they walked to the assisted living wing.
Kind of,
Ginger said, and she opened the door to her mother's new apartment. The studios in the assisted living wing were all L-shaped, so a cot could be moved in if an aide was needed temporarily. Everything, it seemed, was now couched in the language of the temporary. If an aide was needed full-time, Glory would have to be moved to the long-term wing temporarily. There was only one final stop at the Meadows, and no one discussed it.
You're not staying?
Glory asked when Ginger and Mimi put on their coats.
I'll be back tomorrow, Ginger promised,
and she and Mimi left, too tired and sad to speak. At home, Ginger saw Julia and Nick had been playing house in the kitchen. An explosion of pots, strainers, wooden spoons, and bowls rose up out of the sink like a warning. A roast chicken sat on a cutting board, blood seeping out from the center cavity. She got the meat thermometer and stuck it in the thigh.
Jules!
She could hear they were upstairs.
Jules!
She called again. Nick clumped down, loud as a horse.
Julia said to tell you we're in the middle of working on something. Hey, you found our chicken. Want some?
It's not cooked through, she told him, and then noticed that the oven was still on. When you're done cooking, you need to turn the oven off. She opened the oven door and put the chicken back in. She could feel Nick's confusion. She wasn't making any sense. It's fine. Finish what you're doing. I'll watch the bird. By the end of dinner, everyone was mad at everyone. Julia maddest of all. It was their chicken, she complained, bought with their money, and they wanted to cook it their way. But you didn't cook it. It wasn't cooked, was Ginger's first reaction, followed a moment later by, What do you mean, your money? One of the consequences for Julia's missed curfews had been the loss of her allowance. Like Glory's new life in the meadows, the loss was temporary, but the allowance had not yet been reinstated. How do you have money? I just do, Julia said, and when Nick gave her a look, she snapped at him. I'm not getting into it with her now. Anyway, why is it so unbelievable that I know how to get money? Get money? What, did you rob a bank? Ginger turned to Richard. Are you giving her money? He shook his head. Let's go, Julia told Nick. Okay, cool. Nick got up and followed Julia to the basement stairs. Ginger called after them, Plates in the sink! You can't leave the kitchen like this! Julia yelled from the bottom step. Well, take care of it! Don't go insane! I don't know what they're doing down there, Ginger said to Richard as they cleared the table. But they're up to something. She stopped. You don't think they're working on a plan to convince us Nick should move in, do you? Because no way. I draw the line. Absolutely not. No, Richard said, looking sad. He shook his head. I don't think they're planning that. This is how Ginger found out what they were planning. The morning after their chicken dinner fight, she padded downstairs, poured herself a bowl of cereal, sat at the table, and glanced out the window at the morning moon. Richard came down a moment later, and they fell into their new routine, working out the arrangement of the newspaper sections so the pages didn't collide. When the shower went on in the bathroom, Ginger looked at the ceiling and thought, Julia's up early. That's odd. 20 minutes later, when Julia came into the kitchen, wet hair in a ponytail, face glowing and flushed, eyes wide open and bright, Ginger thought, She looks so beautiful this morning. And a moment later, She looks like she's in love. That Julia was clutching a shopping bag in one hand and a black North Face duffel in the other did not register, until Julia put the bags down. Bags at her feet, Julia picked at her cuticles, her cheeks turning bright and then brighter red as she began her halting announcement. Nick was on his way over to pick her up. They were leaving today, moving to Portland, Maine. Nick had friends in Portland who would let them stay for a while. She handed Ginger a piece of paper. We're not definite about where we're going next, but all the cities on the list are cool about buskers. Buskers? Ginger asked. Street performers, Richard said quietly. They scanned the list together. Cambridge, Asheville, New Orleans, San Francisco. Ginger looked up and asked, What are you doing? Moving. Moving out. Today. Now. Ginger repeated the word now. The words had suddenly become nothing more than placeholders, with no meaning attached at all. Her daughter's eyes, blue as Glory's, darted from the table to the walls to the ceiling to the floor, looking anywhere but at her stunned mother. There's conditions. Conditions? Another thing that made no sense. We're planning to stay in Portland until we get the performance all worked out. We've been doing it in the city, on the street, and in the subway, but it's not right yet. Ginger's eyes moved to the shopping bag. The sheet and the helmet with the wings were peeking out from the top. And stuffed in on the side,
It was just a glimpse of fabric, were the Salvation Army uniforms.
You've been performing in the subway in the city?
Julia refused to meet her mother's eyes.
After Portland, we'll probably go to Cambridge. They're totally cool about street performers there. Cambridge is where Amanda Palmer started.
Who?
Street performer turned artist, Richard said.
Ginger wondered how on earth he knew that. Julia interrupted her thoughts.
Doesn't matter. She was working hard to stay on script.
When we're ready to leave Portland, I'll send you a postcard about our next stop. I promise to let you know where we are, so long as you leave us alone.
Pardon me?
You can't try to contact me. No more Facebook stalking. I shut down my page, as I'm sure you're aware.
No contact?
Ginger tried to keep up.
What if there's an emergency?
There's not going to be an emergency, Julia told her.
Probably not, but what if there is?
Ginger lowered her voice.
What if someone gets sick? What if someone dies? What if you get sick?
God, why are you like this? No one's going to get sick.
Julia sighed.
Okay, if someone gets sick, they should go to the doctor. And if someone dies, Dad, you can call Nick's mom. She'll know how to reach us. If someone dies.
And then you'll come home?
Ginger pressed.
Stop. I didn't say that.
She turned to her father.
See what I mean? See how she is?
Okay. Richard's courtroom voice. If something happens, which it won't, I'll call Nick's mom. She'll let you know, but we won't expect you home until
I'm ready.
Ginger looked at Richard to see how this could make sense to him, but he was busy staring at his shoes. She felt lobotomized. Anne Marie would know where Julia was, but Ginger wouldn't. If there was an emergency, Richard, only Richard, could contact Nick's mom. And even then, Julia would not come home until she's ready.
Standing her ground, Julia continued.
We want to be artists. We want to do performance art. But we can't if you won't leave us alone. I know it's hard for you, but you have to try. Because otherwise, if you come looking for us, either of you, if you send Aunt Mimi, or you call the police, or you call Nick's mom for no good reason, we'll move and we won't tell you where. It will be poof, gone, thin air.
Her eyes looked fierce, but Ginger could see the rims were red, a wet film rising.
Julia pressed her lips together, a tick she'd had forever. Seeing it made Ginger's eyes go wet, too.
Julia regained her composure. I sold my phone, so forget about calling. You'll have to be patient and wait for my postcards, which I promise I'll send, so you'll know I'm okay.
You sold your phone?
Ginger wondered exactly how a 17-year-old went about selling a phone that her parents had bought. She glanced at Richard and saw he looked surprised at this, too.
With a start, she realized this was the only thing that seemed to surprise him.
Her body went heavy as stone.
You knew?
Julia leaped to his defense, her anger wiping away everything else.
You can't be mad at him. He's been trying to talk me out of this for weeks.
Ginger mouthed, weeks? We were going to leave last night. I wrote you a note, but Dad said leaving a note was wrong. He said you deserved to hear it face to face. She crossed her arms. So here I am, face to face. If you leave me alone, you'll know where I am. If you try to find me, you won't.
She pressed her lips together again and then added, It's not forever.
For a moment, Ginger couldn't place how old her daughter was. Was she still a child?
Could she do this? Could she just go?
And then, with his usual terrible timing, Nick pulled up in his rusted Saab and beeped, and Julia ran out to meet him. By the time Ginger and Richard got to the curb, Julia's shopping bag and North Face duffel were in the back, and she was in the front, pulling the door closed.
"Go," Julia told Nick.
To her parents, she said,
"Bye."
In a voice too quiet for Julia to hear, Ginger asked,
"Did you buckle up?"
It was Richard who replied.
"She knows how to buckle."
A reminder alarm started beeping. Nick turned the car off and hopped out.
"Back door is stuck again."
He tried to close it, but the latch wouldn't hold. Julia pulled her seatbelt over her shoulder and it clicked in place. Richard moved closer to Ginger.
"I'm sorry. I thought I could talk her out of it. I wanted to tell you after I got her to change her mind."
He reached for her hand. Ginger let him take it. She could see the tendons in her daughter's neck flare out like wings. Julia was working that hard to keep her head from turning toward them. Nick continued to try and close the door with no success.
"I thought if you knew, it would make things worse,"
Richard whispered.
"I was wrong."
How could she be mad at him when she'd done the same thing herself?
"It's okay."
Nick gave one last shove and the door latch held. He got back in and revved the engine. Ginger and Richard stood like a pair of cardboard cutout parents. And Nick's old sob, Ginger wished Julia had never told her the car had no airbags, took off with a screech to the corner. Then, car, boy, daughter, was Julia really no longer a child? Disappeared. Chapter 15. First down the gangplank, there he was, Solly, clutching a large valise with one hand, struggling to balance a heavy wood-framed beach umbrella on his shoulder with the other. Her father, Ginger saw, had not gotten any instructions about blending in.
"A suit?"
Glory backed up at the sight of him.
"He's wearing a suit?"
This shouldn't have been a surprise. Ginger's father always wore a suit for traveling, no matter the destination. The Staten Island Ferry, Ratner's for lunch, Monkey House at the zoo, according to Solly. You go somewhere, you wear a suit. Eyes blinking in the sun, he found his family in the crowd. Grinning, he accelerated, nearly decapitating a woman with his umbrella as he passed.
"Oh, for God's sake!"
Glory swiveled around so she wouldn't see more.
"So?"
Solly said when he finally made his way through the crowd.
"No fireworks to celebrate I'm here?"
He seized Charlie's hand in a firm shake.
"Look at you. Half a foot at least you've grown. I don't see you for a week. You turn into a man."
"He's 8,
Glory reminded him. And Charlie said, "Next month I'll be 9. Solly's delight was not easily diminished. His grin widened as he presented his wife with the umbrella.
"For you."
Glory took another step back.
"What'd you bring that for?"
"Didn't you tell me the umbrella you took from home is too flimsy? Like a toothpick, you said. It falls over. This?"
He offered the umbrella again.
"Solid wood. Weighs a ton."
"An elephant weighs a ton, Solly. You think I want to sit at the beach under an elephant?"
She hurried toward the car and put a quick distance between them. Solly heaved the umbrella, which seemed to have gotten heavier, back on his shoulder.
"So?"
he asked his children, who'd chosen to stay with him, where it seemed safer.
"How much fun have I been missing?"
"Zero,"
Mimi said.
"We don't do anything. Except for Charlie. He's digging to China."
Impressed, Solly whistled, but no sound came out, just air.
"China? That's far to dig."
"I work on it every day," Charlie boasted. "Wait till you see how deep it is."
Solly tousled his hair.
"You got another shovel? I can help you get there faster."
"I'm helping,"
Callie piped up.
"We dig by the dunes, so the tide won't wash it away."
She was proud to know this.
"But I'd rather go to the cut. Will you take me?
Sure, Sally said, having no idea.
When they caught up to Glory, Callie reported that her father was going to help Charlie dig to China, and after that, he was taking her to the cut.
Don't encourage them, Glory said.
And when Sally moved toward the driver's side, she blocked him.
I'm the driver here.
Their father laid the umbrella across the laps of the backseaters, pointy end sticking out the window, and slid into the death seat.
This is nice. For once, the scenery I get to see.
The car barreled along, and Ginger stared into the creases on her father's neck. Until now, she didn't know a neck could look unhappy. Her mother's neck was covered by a hat lifted off one of the iron pegs on the front porch. Somehow, the hat managed to look unhappy, too. When they got to the house, everyone hurried in to change for the beach. By the time Ginger squeezed into her tight suit and rejoined her siblings, her mother was waiting by the car, lipstick back to red, a straight gash across her face.
Sally, are you coming? What is he doing in there?
When he emerged, winded, Glory took in his paisley swim trunks and white terry cloth robe and winced before turning away.
Are we bringing food? Mimi asked as she got in the car. Yesterday, I starved to death, she told her father. Yesterday, lunch was fudge.
Glory drove, hands tight on the wheel.
Take a good look at her, Sally. Does Sarah Bernhardt seem like she's starving to you?
It took a very long time to get to the beach, and when Glory pulled into the lot, Charlie looked out the window and said,
This isn't where we go.
He means this isn't the beach where he's digging to China, Mimi translated. It's a beach, isn't it?
Glory got out of the car and dropped her keys in her purse.
There's plenty of sand. Dig away.
She pulled a lounge chair out of the trunk and started walking.
We'll start a new hole, Sally said. Maybe dig to Japan for a change. I know people in Japan. And won't they be surprised to see us pop out of the ground?
That's okay, Charlie said. I don't have to dig.
Glory sat in her lounge chair, hat low on her head, eyes closed. Mimi asked her father to come in the water with her.
Who could say no to that?
He pulled off his shirt, revealing a torso white as bone, a dark patch of curly hair running in a line down his chest from his neck to his trunks. Glory looked up. Her voice sounded calm, almost sleepy.
You can't do that.
Why not? You need some kind of license to swim here?
You need eyes, Sally. What do you think that red flag is for?
She pointed to the flag they'd passed as they'd walked in.
Red means rough seas. There's no swimming in rough seas.
Sally looked at the ocean.
They call this rough? At Jones Beach, this is calm.
Well, this isn't Jones Beach. They have rip tides here, and the lifeguards don't like it when people drown in rip tides.
She closed her eyes to make him disappear. Sally had not come all this way to fight. He shrugged and moved on to the next task, getting the blanket ready. He had a system for this, which he'd been perfecting for years. He methodically transported a big scoop of sand to each corner, mounding it just so to keep the blanket anchored. When he was finished, he stood up and clapped his hands to get rid of the excess dust. Glory lurched up and brushed herself off.
Why do you have to send a sandstorm in everyone's face? Next time, use rocks, like a normal person.
The day continued like a rock slide, downhill, and no one knew how to stop it. Glory's hat stayed low on her head, her mouth a flat red line, her eyes opened no more than a slit, while Sally, clumsy as a bear, concentrated on rotating on the blanket, side, belly, side, front, side, belly, side, back, to get an even tan. At some point, he groaned his way back upright, got his transistor radio and earplug and lay down, adjusting a pair of white eye cups so that the thin plastic strip sat straight across his nose. Ah. Finally, he was content. Mimi kneeled beside him.
Can I sit by the water if I promise not to go in?
Solly lifted up an eye cup.
Sure. Sit wherever you want.
Glory watched Mimi dart to the water.
You're letting her go alone?
Before Solly could defend himself, Ginger, Charlie, and Callie raced off to join their sister. When the ocean presented a red-bellied jellyfish at Callie's feet like a present, she jumped up and down and sat closer to Charlie. Mimi teased her.
Hey, Callie Claire, do you know what makes a jellyfish's stomach red?
Charlie answered as he investigated.
Blood? He looked at his sisters. I wonder whose.
Although they hadn't gone in the water, the tide had washed over their feet. Ginger examined herself, toes, heel, ankles, to see if she'd been stung.
Blood's not mine. Check if it's yours.
Everyone checked, but the blood wasn't from them. They stared at the waves crashing against rocks, sea spray shooting in the air. No one else was in the water that they could see.
Maybe someone went out too far, Mimi guessed. Maybe they crashed into the rocks. Maybe they're floating in the water now, eyes wide open.
She got up, grabbed the carcass of a horseshoe crab, scooped up the jellyfish and tossed it so that it bounced off Callie's foot.
Did you know jellyfish can sting even when they're dead?
Callie screamed and sprinted to the blanket, crying.
Sorry,
Mimi said quietly. They all turned and watched from a distance as Callie told her mother what just happened. When Callie finished, Glory stood up and started walking toward the path to the car. When they got to the blanket, Solly was already packing up.
We'll come back tomorrow. Everyone will feel better tomorrow.
They were silent in the car, silent when they stopped to pick up pizza, silent in the living room where they sat, paper plates in their laps, eating dinner while Solly fumbled with the TV antenna.
You're wasting your time, Glory said. It doesn't work.
The snowy picture on the screen turned from blizzard to nor'easter. Ginger made out ghostly images of people, three of them running down an alley.
It's the Mod Squad, Mimi said. That blob over there is Peggy Lipton.
No, it's not, Charlie said. It's Link.
I'm living in a lunatic asylum, Glory said.
And then, even though it was only 8 o'clock, she stood and added,
I'm going to bed.
In the morning, as they sat eating breakfast, a steady drizzle of rain hitting the window, Solly told them a headache had come in the night.
Like a train wreck, your mother said is exploding. So she's going to sleep in. But if we keep quiet, maybe leave the house for a while, by lunchtime, she'll be good as new.
As for what they should do now, he was at a loss. They pitched in, coming up with ideas. First stop was the library. After that, they went to town. Next came the carousel, and when they'd had enough of that, it was time for lunch. After lunch came ice cream. And in between it all, Solly stopped at payphones to check on how the headache was progressing. The rain stopped, but the reports stayed grim.
It's like a vice, he said after they went to look at the swans. Like knives stabbing her eyes,
he said after they went on a pony ride.
Like an atom bomb, he said after they finished dinner.
They were eating their second ice cream of the day when Charlie asked, Can we go to the beach even though it's night?
Why not?
Came their father's surprising reply. He took a long time consulting the map in the glove compartment before he picked their destination.
South Beach it is.
They passed a small grocery store on the way, and Mimi suggested they stop to buy flashlights, like the ones they used to come home from Jungle Beach. Ginger was in the front seat, so she couldn't give her sister a warning kick. But it didn't matter. Solly heard nothing in the remark about Jungle Beach to give him pause.
"Excellent idea," was all he had to say.
By the time they pulled into the South Beach lot, the sun was on the horizon. Minutes later, the ocean turned invisible, save for an occasional flash of white from the breakers. Because Callie thought the night beach was scary, Solly carried her up to the nearby lifeguard stand, where, he promised, no monsters could get her. When Mimi asked if she could put her feet in the water, another surprise.
"Why not?"
They stood at the water's edge, mist tickling their faces, and looked up at the stars. Mimi said,
"Maybe we should make wishes."
Ginger wished first that their mother's headache would go away. Charlie wished next that in the morning they could go home to New Jersey. Mimi changed her mind about the whole enterprise.
"Wishes don't work."
They trudged back to the lifeguard stand, the top invisible in the dark, and Charlie pointed his flashlight.
Solly called out, "Watch the eyes!"
"We want to go home,"
Ginger yelled up, and her father said,
"Okay."
"I want to jump off before we go," Mimi shouted,
and another,
"Okay,"
came back. Mimi scrambled up the ladder with Charlie right behind her, both of them aware that at any moment permission might be rescinded. It happened fast. One second, Charlie and Mimi were arguing about who would jump first, and the next second there was a yell and a thud, and Charlie was face down on the ground right next to where Ginger stood. She waited for him to move, but he didn't. Kneeling in the dark, she reached for the closest body part, his foot, and shook it.
"Charlie?"
Her father clambered down the ladder, a noise like a sea lion coming from deep within his chest. She saw the flashlight lying in the sand and turned it on, the beam hitting Charlie's face.
"Quit it," he said, and sat up.
"Oy,"
Solly raced over.
"You all right?"
Charlie nodded.
"Except my arm. I can't move my arm."
The doctor at the hospital explained this was because his arm was broken. When they got to the house, they scattered like vapor. They were in their bedrooms when Solly called upstairs.
"Charlie, your mother wants to see you."
The three sisters changed into their pajamas. Callie didn't want to be by herself, so Ginger let her slide into her bed, sandy feet and all. They lay silent for what seemed like a very long time before they heard their brother's footsteps climbing the stairs. He stopped in the doorway.
"She's not mad. It's okay."
By the time they got up the next day, their father was gone. Chapter 16. Glory's favorite den chair moved with her to the meadows. But though Ginger placed it next to the window, with its view of a small garden, Glory preferred to look the other way, out through her propped-open door into the hall.
"Yoo-hoo!" she'd call to someone shuffling by. "Come and say hello! Don't be a stranger!"
Her adjustment had been surprisingly easy, something Ginger attributed to the upgrade from full-time companion to full-time audience.
"All the girls here love me," Glory reported.
And Ginger stood, "all the girls" meant nurses, aides, social workers, kitchen staff, lady hairdresser, lady doctor, and lady activity director. The activity director, Brooke, who'd been trying to start a theater group for years, loved her most of all.
"Brooke's a warrior, like you," Glory said. "Told me it's impossible to put on plays on account of there's hardly any men. I told her we had hardly any men when they were alive, and we managed."
"Yes," Ginger said, and then realized her mother hadn't asked a question. Over dinner, she told Richard this was happening a lot.
"I zone out. I might look like I'm listening, but really I'm completely caught up in thinking about what I'm going to say when Glory finally remembers to ask about Julia."
"You're doing it again," Richard told her, "making a problem where there isn't one."
Ginger felt the sting of blame in Richard's tone. He never said it outright, but she got the message.
Julia's departure was her fault.
While she conceded this was partly, even mostly true, she would not take all the blame. They were supposed to be a team, and being a team meant what happened was on both of them.
"The fact is," he went on, "your mother would be thrilled to know Julia's out there trying to start a career as a performer. The family tradition continues."
Why did Richard not get that the family tradition was exactly the problem? Seeing Julia go was like seeing Callie leave all over again. And career? Is that what you think Julia's doing? Starting a career?
I would say Julia is trying to live her life.
She didn't have it in her to argue anymore. The fights were too frequent now. Julia's departure seemed to have gotten into the bedrock of their marriage, finding cracks she'd never noticed before. How had she missed Richard's tendency to minimize things? And was she to understand her cautious nature had been irking him for years? That night was the first of what soon became their new routine. Ginger woke around 3 to the sound of Richard leaving their bed to sleep on the couch. In the morning, he defended his change of location. It was because of how she reacted to his snoring, all the jiggling and poking in the ribs to get him to turn over. It bordered on violence. "This?" she gave him a gentle shove. "This is violent?" Richard seemed to have settled on silence as his preferred mode of communication. So it wasn't a surprise that silence was his answer now. When he finally raised the idea of a break, just for a few nights at the Marriott downtown so they could both cool off, Ginger surprised them both by not trying to talk him out of it. Maybe a cooling-off period was what they needed. Maybe after a few days apart they would be able to talk things through without Richard accusing her of worrying Julia right out of the house, or her firing back that Julia wouldn't have left at all if Richard had given Ginger a chance to help figure out a response with him as a team. Now, in addition to worrying about what to say if Glory asked where Julia was, she worried about what to say if Glory asked, "Where's Richard?" As it turned out, neither topic was of interest to her. All conversation with Glory now revolved around her newly formed theater group. As Glory promised, the lack of men was not a problem. But the lack of people who could memorize lines was.
"I finally figured it out,"
she boasted to Ginger one day. "We're going to specialize.
Theater of the absurd."
The excitement of the move to the Meadows fired up the faulty connections in Glory's brain, but not for long. Soon she was back to addled. One morning an aide found her at the elevators, asking a visitor for help getting to the kitchen. The next day a man found her in the parking lot, confused about where she'd left her car. After the first fall, it was clear she needed more care. Because there were no openings in the dementia unit, she was moved, temporarily, to a small room in the long-term wing. Ginger stopped by every day after school to take care of whatever needed doing. She tidied up the odd things that appeared on her mother's night table. One day, a small white box of chocolates. From whom? Another day, a stuffed bear. She reviewed medication with the on-duty nurse, and then, linking arms, took her mother for strolls. To the crafts center, to the library, to the chair yoga room. At the end of her visit, she'd deposit her in the lounge, where a rotation of movies with Constance Bennett, Myrna Loy, and Cary Grant played on the TV in an endless loop. But as soon as Ginger got back in her car, her thoughts would return to Julia, recalculating how long since she'd left. Today it was 4 weeks. And wondering whether there'd be a postcard waiting in the mail when she got home. So far, none had come. But every day she hoped a card was waiting. Some days magical thinking took hold, and she hoped Julia would borrow a phone and send a text. So far, no card, no text, no magic, no luck. At work, she was focused, as always,
applying healing salves to wounds, assessing pustules on rashes, taking notes during mandatory meetings about the new core curriculum, or helping to organize group gifts for the Spanish teacher's baby shower. But in her rare free moments, if there were no meetings to attend and no children to be seen, her mind would track back to Julia, always to Julia, wondering how she was. To get through her days, she sacrificed her nights. No longer did she rotate like a rotisserie chicken in bed, hoping sleep would claim her. Now, when she woke with a start, no matter the time, her brain scrambling to locate the reason for her sense of high alert and distress, she'd get up and go to the computer. Google Earth. Really, all of the web was her new best friend and her most vicious enemy. If she was in a hopeful mood, she would travel virtually through the streets of Portland, streets with lovely names like Spring and Pleasant and Pine, streets that sounded smart, like Oxford, or homey, like Kellogg, zooming in on backyard swing sets and zooming out to study the neighborhood grid. Sometimes a sense of ease would come over her, because surely nothing bad could happen at the corner of Diamond and Pearl. Other nights, when she woke anxious, she'd follow the cursor to Middle Street, to the squat red bricks of the Portland Police Headquarters or to the courthouse, where she'd examine the building so closely she could make out which windows had air conditioner units and which units were reinforced with plywood planks. She'd check the online news after that to learn in real time about car accidents, assaults, and fires. Google Earth would then take her there to the very spot where the incident occurred, so she could search block by block, irrationally. These weren't webcams. For signs of Julia or Nick or their no-airbag car. Always, at some point every night, she'd end up watching videos of street performers. She watched performances in Portland and in Cambridge and in New York City and in San Francisco. She learned to distinguish between walk-by acts, musicians, mimes, living statues, and circle acts. Puppet shows, break dancers, magicians. Though which kind of act Julia and Nick were doing, she really had no idea. She watched the man who called himself a nihilist anarchist. He created puppets out of garbage and dead animals. And the man who offered to eat anything anyone gave him for a price. There was a woman who painted cartoons on walls in abandoned buildings, in front of an audience that consisted of her videographer and rats. There was a young boy, he didn't look like he'd been through puberty yet, whose specialty was sneaking into subway tunnels to do cartwheels inches from where trains passed by. A few of the performers struck her as actual artists. Some had concert hall talent, or great physical grace, or charismatic expansive energy. But many more made her hyperventilate. So many panhandlers. So many mentally ill. She watched as many as she could find. Videos that were dark and grainy, shot in back alleys and subway tunnels. And videos that were professional grade, shots at fairs and festivals. But no performers. No street dancers or festival singers. No sidewalk preachers or panhandlers were wearing Salvation Army jackets and a helmet and a sheet.
"You have to stop,"
Richard said when he came home to pick up more clothes and found her hunched over her computer still in her robe.
"You're going to be late for work."
Her first response was to bristle. He was speaking to her as if she were a child. But when she turned around and saw the tenderness in his face, she let it go. Maybe the temporary separation was working. Maybe they would be able to find a way to bring kindness back into their marriage. That didn't stop her grief, though. It built up like acid reflux, a nagging irritation that grew to outright pain. Finally, in her nightly web travels, she stumbled upon a way to relieve it. The Portland Family Crisis Shelter posted a wish list every week. So now, every week, she sent a care package. She sent towels or toothbrushes or shampoo, whatever they wanted,
and as a bonus, she'd add a flyer with safety tips. Insects to watch out for, or how to clean a wound. She knew this wasn't helping Julia. Julia wasn't living in a shelter. But at least she was doing something. Because weekends had a yawning emptiness, she chose Friday afternoons before her daily visit to Glory to make the care packages. This week, nightlights were on the crisis shelter wish list, so she filled her shopping cart with 20 gender-neutral models of balloon bouquets and winking moons. It was at the last minute that she saw the Tinkerbells. Julia had a Tinkerbell nightlight when she was a young child. Ginger still remembered the night it broke. Julia woke them up to say the light had gone out in the fairy's eyes. She'd refused to sleep in her room until the problem was fixed. It took Ginger days to finally locate a replacement. These Tinkerbells looked completely different. But still, Ginger knew it was a mistake as soon as she grabbed them. The Tinkerbells, six of them, unnerved her as they stared from the shopping cart. And they unnerved her on the counter at the shipping store. Even after she'd left them behind, all boxed up and waiting to be loaded on the truck, she'd hurried, as if at any minute the Tinkerbells might come after her.
"Long time no see," her mother said when she finally got to the meadows.
"I was here yesterday," Ginger said, slipping off her coat. She sat in the chair by the bed. Her mother offered a pleasant smile, always disconcerting. Was it the smile that made her ask? Was it because the Tinkerbells had upset her? Or was it because she was just so worn down she could no longer control the impulse? Whatever the reason, the question that had been much on her mind now came out of her mouth.
"How did you handle it when Callie left home?"
The smile vanished, and Glory looked away, but Ginger didn't stop.
"After Charlie died, how did you go on?"
Glory met her eyes. 61824?
What?
Her mother looked at her quizzically and then repeated the numbers. Ginger felt woozy. Was this it? The next stage of Glory's decline? Digits? Had her mother's speech gone in one moment from normal to numerical? She'd heard of this, but never observed it. Sentences that held all characteristics of regular speech, clauses and pauses, intonations and questions, but were composed not of words, but of numbers. Or was this a ploy? It wouldn't be unthinkable for the Queen of Deflection to cook up her most creative duck-and-dodge scheme ever just to avoid Ginger's unwanted prying. Her mother glanced across the room and repeated the numbers again. 61824? No one's at the door. It was disturbing to think that her mother was using number speak to change the subject, and even more disturbing to consider the possibility that the number language was the result of an episode of neurologic dysfunction. But it was also troubling that somehow, even when her mother spoke in numbers, Ginger completely understood. Was it the tone? Exactly what her mother meant to be saying.
5, 4, 2, 8, 10?
Her mother pointed to Ginger's wrist. Ginger looked at her watch.
I'm not late again.
Her mother's face rearranged into a scowl, and her gaze skipped to the top of Ginger's head.
1:50, 2:34?
Ginger checked to make sure her barrette was still in place.
I didn't do anything to my hair. Can you please go back to words?
Her mother let out an exhausted sigh and lay her head back on her pillow. It was a new king-sized pillow, Ginger noticed. Mimi must have been here. This was how her sister made up for infrequent visits. By bringing things. A set of exquisitely embroidered pillowcases. A crisp new duvet cover. A scented diffuser. One time in a tinted glass bottle, another time in a dented tin, which Mimi made sure everyone knew came from a tiny store in the south of France. Her mother started snoring softly, and Ginger got busy, her long fingers tucking in the clothes that poked out of the dresser drawers as if attempting escape. The drawers had been like this for days now,
slightly ajar and off their bearings. Inside were soft sweater sets in pastel colors, fine wool trousers with mother-of-pearl buttons, structured undergarments, some wrapped in tissue paper with tags on, others so old it was hard to tell which body part they were intended for. Ginger moved quickly, as if the clothes were hot to the touch. Something red peeked out of the bottom drawer, and for a confusing moment Ginger wondered how the bathing suit she bought for Julia last summer had ended up here. Of course, it hadn't. She'd returned that bathing suit the day she got it. It was a stupid impulse purchase made when she was still struggling to train herself to stop doing that. Stop buying things for Julia because whatever she bought was wrong. Wrong size, wrong fit, wrong idea. But the color of the bathing suit was such a close match to Julia's hair. It was a whim. More magical thinking, really. As if a present could change the atmosphere inside a house. She let go, and the silky garment, a slip she saw now, slithered back into the drawer. Her mother's eyes opened. She let out a whoosh of air, like a balloon deflating. And as if she'd just then decided number speak was no longer necessary, she asked a normal question the normal way.
"You going to visit me tomorrow?"
"I visit you every day." Glory rubbed her hand.
"It's been bothering me all of a sudden."
"Your fingers? Arthritis?" Her mother closed her eyes again.
"Good night, Gingy."
She was dismissed. In the hallway, Ginger bumped into Glory's social worker, Tracy, a woman of terrifying high energy who'd recently called a family meeting to discuss Glory's diminishing appetite. Ginger told her the real mystery was how anyone could digest in the Meadows Cafe, where no amount of exclamation points, crepes, fricassee, souffle, could hide that everything smelled as if it was on the brink of going bad. And the food wasn't the only problem. In the Meadows Cafe, no opinion went undeclared. It was like a bingo hall gone berserk. Residents shouting above the thrum of oxygen concentrators to share fragments of every flickering memory that popped into their heads. Add to that the sighing and the belching. It really was a wonder anyone ate anything at all. For once, Tracy wasn't smiling.
"Did your sister tell you I called?"
"No." Why hadn't Mimi told her?
"Oh, your mom had a TIA. Your sister didn't understand at first, not being a health professional and all. She got scared, thought a TIA was the same as a major stroke. I told her there's no need to worry yet, that a lot of times a TIA will resolve with no ill effects at all. I did suggest she stop in and visit, though. When is a visit a bad thing, right?"
So Glory's number speak wasn't a ploy. And Mimi knew about it and didn't call.
"Bad timing, though," Tracy said, "your mom being so excited about her performance. You should have told me she was an opera singer."
"My mom was an opera singer? You're teasing me, right? Very funny. Well, I'm going to go visit her now, see if I can get her to sing. You know how sometimes people with aphasia can sing even when they can't speak?"
"Her words are back," Ginger said. "I just left her. She's herself again."
"Super," Tracy said. "You should come tonight. I think she said she wants to sing something from La Boheme." She hurried on to cheer up the next person on her list. At the elevator bank, a woman in a wheelchair called over to her.
"Hello, lady with the dog."
She said this to Ginger every day now, and Ginger no longer bothered to correct her. At Glory's house, she went inside to check on the progress of the painter. That was the division of labor. Ginger oversaw and Mimi paid. The kitchen, walls a clean, creamy white, smelled of paint, but the painter was gone. No more work would be done in Glory's house today. She caught herself. This was not Glory's house anymore. That head-banging discovery came the day after Glory's move into the Meadows, when Ginger, attending to the mountain of her mother's past due bills, came upon a statement for a reverse mortgage that neither sister knew anything about. She immediately called Mimi and shared the news that without consulting them, Glory had taken out a reverse